Hello, I'm Lina Ahmadou. Welcome to Health Chat. Do you consider yourself a happy person? If the answer is yes, that's great. If the answer is no, well, experts say being happy can make you healthier. They say the link between a person's thoughts, feelings, and behavior can affect their physical well-being. In a scientific review published in the medical journal Applied Psychology, Health and Well-being, researchers found that, among other things, happiness has some beneficial effects on cardiovascular health, immune systems, and longevity. Furthermore, happy people likely take better care of themselves, choose healthy behaviors like exercising and eating well over unhealthy people. The World Happiness Report is a landmark survey of the state of global happiness published in recent years that ranks 156 countries by how happy their citizens perceive themselves to be. We traveled to Togo to find out what perception citizens have of the concept of happiness. The answer is in this report from our correspondent in Lomé, Kayi Lawson.
Ranked 139th in the world out of 156 countries in the 2019 Happiness Index, Togo ranks 33rd on the mainland continent of Africa, behind Zambia and ahead of Liberia. The Togolese thus find themselves in the category of the least happy people on the planet. They have specific indicators that allow them to define their happiness.
For the Togolese, the first thing is to have a job, then move on to creating a family. When he already has a job, a family, he will try to build his house. So these three elements contribute to the appreciation of happiness in Togolese.
For folks who practice religion, they say happiness goes beyond the material.
Happiness is relative. What will make me happy today? Maybe marriage. What will make me happy tomorrow? You might be trading. What will make the other happy? Maybe it's 5 francs. Someone who will have been given a billion, and the person will be in a state of maybe depressed. To be happy, as we say to ourselves, is to have this peace of Christ, this inner peace.
Seen from this angle, happiness is therefore a state of mind that is limited in time. The perception of happiness is different from person to person.
For my part, I will say that I'm happy, that I have happiness in me when I can do good to others. In that sense, I'm happy. Sometimes I'm happy, but not always 100%, because sometimes the intended goal is not achieved.
With these definitions, do the Togolese people feel they are happy?
I will not say that the Togolese are happy, as long as we have the impression that, despite the effort we make to satisfy our desires, there is something blocking us.
In absolute terms, we cannot say that the Togolese are happy. In general, it is good to live. With effort, we will each achieve our own happiness. As Margaret Mead said, happiness is not an end station. It is a way to travel.
For more insights on happiness and well-being, I spoke with Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar, co-founder of the Happiness Studies Academy.
Yeah, my definition of happiness includes 5 elements. It includes the spiritual element, the physical element, the intellectual element, the interpersonal relational element, and finally, of course, the emotional element. And it's when we're able to integrate these 5 elements in our lives, spiritual, physical, intellectual, relational, and emotional, that we lead a happy, full, and fulfilling life.
But that sounds like a lot of components there. Is it ever possible to have all the 5 together at once?
Yes, so you're right. And the nice thing about these 5 elements is that they're interconnected. In other words, there is a way in through any of them. I may decide that I want to focus on my happiness through the physical channel, and then I introduce regular exercise into my life. I can decide that I want to go in through the spiritual element of happiness, and then I do meditation. And even 5 minutes of meditation a day can go a long way. I can choose to invest more in my relationships or to appreciate more, to be more grateful and cultivate more pleasurable emotions, or learn more and going through the intellectual path. So going through any one of these 5 elements is a viable and potential path to happiness.
So Can I also say that we can have happiness if we only have one or two of the elements? So we have to have five of them at all times to be considered happy or to be happy.
Well, so the first question is, what does it really mean to be happy? You know, many people ask me, so Tal, you've been in this field for 30 years. Are you happy? And my answer to that is that I don't know, because I don't think there is a point before which we're unhappy, after which we are happy. In other words, it's not a binary 0-1. Rather, it's a continuum. In other words, today I'm happier than I was 30 years ago. At the same time, I certainly hope to be happier 5 years from now than I am today. It's a journey, and it's a lifelong journey that ends when life ends. And the question is, how can I become happier? And I can become happier even if I just focus on one of the five areas. Now, if I completely neglect one of those five areas, for example, completely neglect my relationships or completely neglect physical health, then of course that is going to negatively affect my happiness. But do I need to focus on all of them all the time? No, that's not possible.
It sounds more realistic then. So in general, what have you found? What makes people happy, really? Is it influenced by culture, by the country? Or are there some key factors that determine how much people are happy or how they are happy or if they're happy?
Yeah, no. So this is a very important question. You see, there are universal elements to happiness that relate to someone having been raised in New York City. And it's the same if you're raised in Nairobi or Beijing. However, at the same time, there are also cultural differences. So, you know, some cultures are more individualistic. Some cultures are more focused on achievement and accomplishment. And these, of course, go into the equation of happiness. But the fundamentals are about human beings. And a human being is a human being is a human being. For example, we all need relationships, whether you're in New York, Nairobi, or Beijing. We all need to be physically active, regardless of where you're from. We all want a sense of meaning and purpose in our lives. And these are the important elements of the science of happiness studies. Then there are the cultural differences. And then, no less important, there are also individual differences. You know, one of the things that I emphasize in all my work through the Happiness Studies Academy is on, in addition to doing research, is doing me search. So research looks at generalities. Me search looks at individual difference. What would provide me with spiritual well-being? What would provide me with emotional well-being? And that may be different from other people.
Very interesting, the me search. I guess perhaps it should start there, right? What makes me happy before I can try to make someone else happy, right?
Very much so. You know, this is a central key to leading a happy life because, for example, there's a lot of research on journaling and people who engage in journaling, and that is me search. That is basically asking how I'm doing, what should I do more of? People who start there are not just happier, they're also in a better place from which to help others. As Carl Rogers, the famous psychologist, said, what is most personal is most general. So we start with the self and then we expand outwards to other people.
There are studies that show that there is a direct link between happiness and physical health and well-being. Can you speak on that?
Happiness is a very good medicine. People who cultivate well-being, psychological well-being in their lives, are not just happier, they're also physically healthier. I'm not a psychotherapist, a clinical psychologist, but if I were and I was seeing patients, the first question that I would ask them is, do you exercise regularly? Because if the answer was no, I would not just encourage them, I would push them to exercise. The research showing the connection between physical health and mental health is mind-boggling. In fact, regular physical exercise, as little as 3 times a week, 30 minutes each time, of jogging or walking or swimming or dancing or whatever your favorite sport is, 30 minutes 3 times a week has the same effect on our psychological well-being as our most powerful psychiatric medication. In fact, it works in the same way, releasing norepinephrine, serotonin, dopamine, you know, the feel-good chemicals in the brain. So exercising is a human need. And just as we need certain vitamins or oxygen, we also need physical exercise. Unfortunately, in today's world, too many of us have the luxury of being able, and I'm saying luxury in quotations, the luxury of not moving. It's unhealthy. We need to move it, move it.
Move it, move it indeed. Now, you are co-founder of the Happiness Studies Academy. You mentioned the academy earlier. Talk to us about what the academy is and how do you teach happiness?
So what the Happiness Studies Academy is about is answering two questions. The first question is, how can I become happier? And the second question is, how can I help others become happier? So we have students from over 60 countries around the world who come there in order to find more happiness in their lives and in order to help their coaches or their clients, if they're therapists, or their colleagues in business, or their students in school. And what it is all about is identifying evidence-based, so scientific interventions that can actually help people attain higher levels of well-being. And what we know is that if we increase levels of well-being, we also enjoy higher levels of creativity and productivity and better relationships, more overall success, as well as physical health. So there are all those benefits to increasing levels of happiness that go beyond the fact that it feels good to feel good, which of course is an important benefit.
So the Academy's mission is to lead the happiness revolution. How so?
So, you know, there are external revolutions and there are internal revolutions. We are, of course, about the internal revolution. We money, achievements, accolades, and actually happiness resides in the places that our grandmother told us about, you know, invest in people. The first step for acquiring happiness is allowing in unhappiness. So expecting to lead a life that is only happy or that we're always experiencing a high, that's unrealistic. And embracing, accepting painful emotions is critical for happiness. And then we need to lead an active life. We need to lead a life where we're constantly learning new things. If we have time for meditation or other form of mindfulness practice, that is great. And most importantly, invest in our relationships. The number one predictor of happiness is quality time we spend with people we care about and who care about us.
Tal Ben-Shahar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on your show.
We wanted to know what makes you happy. Is it a good job, money, spirituality, or perhaps a big house? Anastasie Chidesh has your answers from Kinshasa.
Nature as well as money. Nature and the environment make me really happy. And money? Money is the answer to everything.
What makes me really happy is the fact that despite the difficult moments we cross, I still see people smiling and being positive. This is a difficult moment, but it makes me happy when I see people fighting against the unknown.
When I am praying and in the presence of God, and when I read the Bible, I am very happy. I read about Him, I dance, I shout in joy.
It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Join Issues in the News moderator Dan Raviv and a panel of prominent Washington journalists. They deliberate the latest top stories of the week, including results of the November 3rd presidential election between President Donald Trump and his Democratic challenger Joe Biden. Don't miss Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Welcome back to Health Chat. Earlier, we looked at happiness. Now, if happiness is good for your health, the opposite is true when it comes to anger. Do you get angry when someone cuts you off in traffic? Does your blood pressure rocket when your child refuses to cooperate? We wanted to know what you do when you get angry. Here is what some of you had to say in Lagos.
Well, when I get anger, it depends on the kind of anger I get due to the situation of things at that moment. Like, for instance, in my home, when I get anger, I don't have to be aggressive at the moment. I have to go out and chill out just for my temperature to calm down. And when I see that I'm okay, then I will not come back home for me to handle the situation in a quiet perspective. So I will not do otherwise.
Okay, when I'm hungry, I used to be careful so that I will not overreact over the issue. I may leave the scene, then go back to that person later. If the person says sorry, fine. If he doesn't say sorry, fine. Because I know that so many people are frustrated.
So for some reason, I don't get angry. I don't know if it's my nature, but whenever I do, I just step away from the situation. I try to understand, I try to realize or think about it, and then I realize that it's not going to be forever. Whatever situation that got me angry, it's not going to last for so long. Worst case scenario, in 24 hours or 1 week, it's all gone. So I tend to remember that and I just forget about it. I take myself away from the situation and I try to think of other things that make me happy and I forget about it.
Of all the changes the COVID pandemic has forced on the world, the sense of isolation can be one of the most challenging. And it turns out that, according to psychologists who study the effects of isolation on mental health, all that social distancing has literally made us socially distant. Ostap Yahish has the story.
Psychiatrists say the COVID pandemic and the focus on social distancing has made us all a bit more lonely and a bit more awkward around other people.
I would like to emphasize the consequences of isolation and loneliness the most, because it is, no doubt, an extremely important factor that affects both physical and mental health. People who spend a long time in isolation, like prisons or hospitals or Antarctica, if you will, definitely lose certain social skills. And the longer they stay, the more they lose.
Mark-Ian Prohasko spent almost 2 months in Antarctica. He went there in early 2019 to write a book about the experience of being at a polar station. Later, during quarantine, Mark-Ian often drew parallels with his time at the South Pole.
When you're staying at home, sometimes you don't even want to see anyone, but you can always do so. But when circumstances force you to stay at home, you suddenly feel a certain constraint. You can't go anywhere, although you would like to. In Antarctica, it's the same.
After returning from the expedition, it took some time for Mark-Ian to adapt to normal life.
When I returned, on the one hand, I wanted to lie low for a few weeks, not to communicate with anyone, maybe only with the loved ones. What can I say? How can I explain it all? On the other hand, many of the things that are common here seemed pointless for a while. I went outside, people were going somewhere. What were they doing?
Experts say there is little doubt people will lose certain social skills during the pandemic. Just as muscles atrophy without exercise, communication skills suffer from isolation. That's why it's important to take care of your mental health.
Communication, human socialization, is no less important than work, exercise, diet, sleep, etc. This is an extremely important element. If people think that during quarantine, half an hour should be spent on exercising, people should also think about the importance of social communication.
And experts add, even the smallest things can help.
If our listeners wanted to improve their mental health today, I would advise them to call and meet with a good old friend with whom they have not talked for a long time, and just talk with him or her for a while.
A wearable device called Bump that warns you when you forget to socially distance helped this year's London Marathon take place despite the COVID-19 restrictions.
A necklace encouraging you to keep a social distance. Meet Bump, the wearable device that helped this year's London Marathon take place despite restrictions due to COVID-19. Andrew Nicholson is the group marketing manager at Tharsis, Bump's developer.
Bump's a wearable device around your neck, and it makes two signals, blue when you're 2 metres away from another Bump wearer, and red and a loud beep when you're 1 metre away.
The device was worn by the 100 elite athletes and 500 race staff to help maintain the biosecure bubble ahead of the marathon on October 4, alerting the wearer when they came within 2 metres of another device. Bump also allowed race organisers to log how often and for how long elite athletes and event staff spend within a predefined distance of each other, and will be used to track and trace should someone test positive within 2 weeks of the race. The London Marathon's director, Hugh Brasher, believes the technology can go beyond marathons.
I think that this technology can be used in business, really importantly. If your company is trying to come back to the office, so many conversations going on about how do you ensure someone's safety. Health and safety is so important these days, not only offices but warehousing. And absolutely, could it be used in marathons in the future? Yes, but I think it's much wider about how it can be used to get us back to some form of normality.
Now, in South Africa, they're calling it pandemic fatigue. Despite climbing COVID-19 infection rates, health authorities say increasing numbers of citizens are disobeying regulations designed to prevent the spread of the virus. The country is enduring the world's longest lockdown, with restrictions such as ban on large public gatherings still in place. Darren Taylor has more.
A survey of thousands of South Africans' views on the pandemic has revealed they're much less afraid of contracting the coronavirus than they were just a few months ago.
And of course, that level of decreased fear means that people are not taking public health measures as seriously.
Dr. Karen Runciman is a researcher at the Centre for Social Change.
Not wearing masks every time that they go out, a greater number of people reporting having gone to large gatherings with more than 50 people. And again, obviously, the less compliant people are with public health measures, the greater the likelihood of transmission of the virus.
Scientists say this is exactly what's happening, with almost all cities reporting more infections and deaths the past 3 weeks. Runciman says her study shows a very dangerous opinion is contributing to this.
A greater number of adults think the threat of the coronavirus has been exaggerated. So what we see is in the hard lockdown, only about 3 in 10 adults say that they think the threat of the coronavirus is exaggerated. As we come now to September, we see that number growing, and it's now 4 in 10.
She says this may seem like a small increase in scepticism, but it translates into millions of people not taking the pandemic seriously.
And it underscores the importance for continued and strong public health messaging, you know, not just around wearing of masks, but also the importance of hand washing. You know, we have to remind ourselves that those little squirts of sanitizer that we get when we walk into the shops, you know, are not enough in and of themselves. Hand washing continues to be one of the best ways to protect ourselves.
Runciman says laxness is normal this far into a pandemic, so the government should cooperate with mental health experts to find strategies to overcome it.
What also is very important coming through the survey findings is the considerable economic distress and impact the pandemic has had on people. So the survey shows that 4 in 10 adults are going to bed hungry, and this is nearly double what it would be before the pandemic.
So the researcher says it's critical that the state provides more social relief to the poor as a way to stem the tide of new infections.
In my analysis, I think when people are weighing up the real risk of hunger and that real feeling and the threat of catching something that you can't see and you can't touch, that is playing a real role here in people's pandemic fatigue. So we have to think about this as a coordinated response, thinking about not just the mental health impacts, but also the economic impacts, and trying to address those together as far as we can.
President Cyril Ramaphosa's office says he'll address the nation soon about the recent rise in infections and deaths. He's expected to remind South Africans of their responsibilities in curbing the spread of COVID-19 and to threaten a return to a hard lockdown if they fail to listen. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Britain is set to go into lockdown for a second time Thursday amid a surge in coronavirus infections, with over 20,000 new cases reported daily. It's the latest European country to impose strict measures, as Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Last orders again for Britain's pubs and restaurants. A nationwide lockdown will go into effect on Thursday, forcing all non-essential shops and services to close their doors for at least 4 weeks. Schools and universities will stay open. Government scientists say infection rates are exceeding worst-case scenarios modelled just weeks ago, and warn deaths could soon exceed the springtime peak. Prime Minister Boris Johnson told lawmakers Monday the lockdown is vital to protect Britain's National Health Service.
If we allow our health system to be overwhelmed, exactly as the data now suggests, then that would not only be a disaster for thousands of COVID patients, because their survival rates would fall, we would also reach a point where the NHS was no longer there for everyone. The sick would be turned away because there was no room in our hospitals.
Johnson had, until now, resisted calls for a second lockdown, despite sharply rising infection rates through September and October. Over two-thirds of Britons support the measures, according to a poll published Monday. So will it work? Scientists are unsure.
Particularly with schools, there's some evidence that older children are drivers of infection. So keeping those schools open means that driving down the number of infections in the UK will be more difficult than it otherwise would have been. So we'll see what effect that has over the coming month.
The government has extended its furlough scheme, which pays 80% of workers' wages at firms hit by the lockdown, alongside grants for businesses forced to close. During the first lockdown, the British economy shrunk by a fifth. Many companies rely on Christmas trading to boost profits, and there are fears of further economic pain.
We're just going to end up going through this weird cycle of closing and opening and closing and opening, and people are just going to continue to lose their jobs and rely on government support to pay their rent.
British lawmakers are expected to vote through the new lockdown plans Wednesday, but this time there is greater opposition to the measures. Nigel Farage, not an MP, but widely seen as the architect of Britain's exit from the European Union, has announced plans to rebrand his Brexit party into the Reform Party, with opposition to the lockdown its central theme. This despite the World Health Organization this week saying Europe is once again the epicenter of the pandemic. France and Belgium have imposed nighttime curfews in addition to month-long lockdowns as infections surge. In Spain, protesters clashed with police amid lockdown measures in several regions. Germany and Italy, along with several other European states, have imposed tighter restrictions. The hope is that locking down now will mean an easing of the rules for Christmas. But if infections remain high, European governments say the lockdowns could last for several more weeks. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And that's it for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/voahealthchat, and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Moudou, in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and wash your hands more frequently, and strive to make every day a healthy day.